Welcome to the Reformed Media Review. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here again with Jeff Waddington. We have in front of us a very interesting book here titled Christosis. It's written by Ben C. Blackwell, published by Moore Seebeck in their Wissenschaftliche Untersuchungen zum Neuen Testament series. My German pronunciation is a little sloppy here.
That would be the academic examination of the New Testament.
Yeah. Yes, it would be. I passed my exam, but the exam doesn't include a pronunciation portion. So, but this book, of, as you might guess or gather from the title, Christosis, is roughly treading in the waters, actually directly within the waters of the Eastern Orthodox doctrine of theosis and deification. Jeff, have you seen recent titles on deification and theosis? There seems to be a resurgence.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, a graduate of the PhD program at Westminster, Brandon Withrow, has done a book on Edwards and theosis. The new McClyman McDermott, a year old now, their theology of Jonathan Edwards argues in favor of Edwards holding to some form of divinization or participation. Mm-hmm. And they chastised me for disagreeing with them.
That'll happen.
But that's all the rage, isn't it?
It sure is. It's a hot topic in even in reform circles. We have figures like Karl Moser. Ben Blackwell here is more evangelical, but he's still treading in the same waters. So you think of guys like Robert Lethem, who are speaking about these themes in books such as his book Union with Christ, and then J. Todd Billings is exploring the ways in which the Eastern tradition might provide new perspectives or new light upon soteriology. So there's a lot of attention given to this doctrine or these doctrines of late here. The subtitle of this book, Christosis, is this: Pauline Soteriology in Light of Deification in Irenaeus and Cyril of Alexandria. So this was originally a dissertation at Durham, it has been reformatted a little bit and published here in this monograph series. So it's not a cheap title, especially from Moore Seebeck. It's a paperback book that lists for $135. So it's
a pale green cover.
Grayish with gray. Blue. Okay. Yeah, it's maybe I could. I
well,
will.
Well, the hardbacks had the gray with the blue print.
That's exactly what we have here. Now, I didn't buy this out of pocket. I'm finishing a review for the Westminster Theological Journal. Hopefully, that'll get published. And this is probably something you're going to want to get through your library. Little secret here, insider secret. Durham dissertations are available online, so I hate to let the cat out of the bag, but you're not going to get the monograph version, but you can find this online if you do a search. I hate to put the screws to Moore Seebeck there, but in the name of scholarship, I'll just let people know that. Very interesting book. I really enjoyed reading it. A lot of interesting themes in here, things to think about, and some creative proposals here toward the end, which I think are worth chatting about. I'll get to them in a minute. The first half of the book is spent on basic stuff. There's not much of a literature review. There is one, but it's not lengthy. But you get into arguments for how he's going to go about his work. And he's espousing what he calls a history of interpretation model. That's from figures like Gadamer and Jauss. Bakhtin, I think, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's a way of studying. And what he's doing is he's taken two representative figures, two representative Pauline interpreters from the early church, Irenaeus and Cyril of Alexandria, and he's looking at how they interpreted Paul. And then he's looking at their doctrines of theosis and deification to see if they shed light, later interpreters here, if they shed light on or unlock or unopen some features of Pauline soteriology that were previously unnoticed or maybe underappreciated. So to see whether or not that is the case, first he does kind of an historical study, and he does study deification in Irenaeus and Cyril of Alexandria. Clears up some basic misconceptions about theosis, and for many in the ancient church, theosis, or becoming like God, simply meant becoming immortal. For them, immortality equaled divinity. And so there are a whole host of different versions of theosis that do not necessarily mean a bridging of or a breaching of the creator-creature distinction. Were you aware of that, Jeff?
No. Well, I sensed it, and sometimes I've wondered.
It's not always been plain.
Yeah. When I've looked at discussions of theosis, some of them look merely like, okay, we get to share in the love of God. The love of God, of course, is between the Father and the Son. The Holy Spirit is love personified, and therefore you participate in the triune deity.
Right.
Which that's very strikes me as a somewhat loose way of talking. I'm sure there are more precise and definite ways to do
that. You know, I agree with you there. I think if that's all we mean, I find the words deification and theosis rather unfortunate or confusing, and we'll get to this in just a moment of what he means by his proposal here, Christosis, which I think is actually helpful, but we want to go a little bit further. But the second half of the book really is trying to unpack Pauline's soteriology, and he does pretty lengthy treatments of several key Pauline texts that, you know, are typically used as arguments for theosis. Here we have Romans 8, and then we have 2 Corinthians 3 through 5, of course, and then a couple excursies in Colossians, and then also with Philippians 2 through 3, I believe. So he does treat Pauline texts directly at length. He doesn't get into a whole host of grammatical arguments, so he's not doing very, very deep exegesis down to the grammar and syntax level. But at a theological level, I think he does put in his time, and it's very helpful in the way that he unpacks some features of Pauline soteriology. Overall, generally useful. Now, he would definitely anticipate this, and he suggests as much in the book, but people like you and me, Jeff, are going to have a very large bone to pick with some of his formulations of justification.
I was going to ask you, the stress on deification strikes me as creating potential problems with the doctrine of justification.
It does, and this is what happens. He's very appreciative of the work of Michael Byrd, and he emphasizes, along with Byrd, that justification is not just a transfer term. It's not simply forensic, the way that many Reformed, we should say every Reformed person has argued that when you're justified, it's a declaration of God's righteousness, or a declaration of our righteousness, a pardon of our sin, and a forgiveness of our sin, strictly based on the imputed righteousness of Christ alone. But for Byrd, and Blackwell is very sympathetic, justification is also participation. And so you tread into those waters. I don't think that makes the book useless to Reformed people at all. I think the book is actually can be quite useful, asks a number of good questions, and presents a number of helpful things for us. And even if you just read it for a description, I think it's quite useful, and documentation, because he's definitely done his work and research, and the bibliography itself is very helpful for someone who wants to get into this field. Here's the interesting part. He's concerned to see that salvation in Paul, especially when we look at Romans 8:29, is all about being conformed to the image of Christ. And so he wants to understand the doctrine of theosis in terms of conformity to that image. Even better than this is that he wants to understand that this image is not simply just one aspect of Christ, but it's his death and resurrection. It's the whole Christ. That's what he wants to argue for. So that conformity to the image in the way that Lane Tipton would want to speak, it's about suffering unto glory.
Right.
And that's what we see in Philippians chapter 2. And it's very helpful to think that way, and it's very rich and robust, and I think very biblical. And so I think where he goes slightly wrong here, very wrong, is when you start to conflate things that the Reformed tradition has generally kept separate, well, not separate, kept distinct.
Right.
And so what we have in justification is a forensic reality. It's a declaration that happens for the believer because he's received an alien righteousness. Now, when we're raised from the dead, when we're resurrected, clearly that has some relationship to our justification because death is the punishment for sin. And so when you are raised from the dead, there is an open declaration or a manifestation now of your triumph over sin, an open vindication of your righteousness. Again, it's alien, but it's an open vindication of the work that God has done in your life. But what happens is that declaration that Reformed people want to hold on to and call justification, 2 Timothy 3:16 is an example of how that happens in the life of Christ. But that gets blurred, and the resurrection itself and the participation all starts to bleed into one thing. So you don't have justification being one specific thing anymore. You end up having it being more or less kind of an amorphous, soteriological, and transformative reality.
Oh, I think wasn't Michael Byrd working in that direction as well?
Yeah, that's where right. He cites Michael Byrd in a number of places and saying that that's the work he's very appreciative of. And so, and he also understands, and he's very forthright and recognizes that many of us in what, you know, he would call the Western tradition and the Reformed tradition are not going to like this proposal. So it's not a surprise to him. But, you know, for the concerns of our listeners, we need to, of course, need to share this information. And even though it's an expected response, it's still something that we need to be critical of and mention in a review. So I think there's a lot of useful stuff here in terms of understanding what it means to be transformed. What does it mean when Paul talks about us being saved? And I think Romans 8:29 is a programmatic text. It is about being conformed to the image of Christ. Paul says that's really what the purpose of predestination was, so that we would be conformed to the image of Christ, so that Christ would be the firstborn of many brothers. And so then we need to ask, well, what does that mean to be conformed to Christ's image? What does it mean in 2 Corinthians 3 when it says that we're being transformed from one degree of glory to another? And I think all the benefits have something to do with glory. Traditionally, we've typically thought about glorification strictly being bodily resurrection. I think most specifically that is what glorification is. But if 2 Corinthians is talking about one degree of glory to another, and we're talking about a conformity to the image of Christ, clearly, when I'm justified, now I reflect God's glory in a new way that I didn't before. When I'm adopted, for instance, even though adoption is forensic, I believe, that still has something to do with me reflecting now quite better the image of Christ. So as the Spirit applies salvation to us, as the Spirit works in our lives, he's making us, he's transforming us from one degree of glory to another. But that's not to say that justification is transformative or that acceptance into God's family now is a transformative reality, that type of thing. So I think we can maintain specificity, we can maintain distinction without blurring all the benefits into one kind of amorphous transformative reality, but we can still have the value in terms of understanding what the Spirit's doing and making us more like Christ. And so for that reason, I think the book Christosis is very useful to get us thinking about new things, but yet it falls short in a couple key departments that our Reformed listeners are going to have trouble with.
I'm assuming there's got to be some discussion of union with Christ, although it appears as if
There's a few, he touches upon that a few times, but it's not a chapter. It's not a sustained treatment. It's mentioned once in a while. And it's an important feature of the book, but it's more implicit, I think.
Oh, okay. Because that would seem to be the overarching theme when we're talking about being conformed to the image of the Son. That I typically think in terms of sanctification, although justification plays its part as well.
Right. And yeah, adoption. Most people, I think, would agree with your thoughts there. But, you know, what is Christ if we're going to be conformed to his image? He's the righteous one.
Right. That's true. That's why once you
he's
think
the vindicated
it through,
one. Yeah. Yeah.
Once you think it through, that becomes almost to be conformed to the image is maybe another way of talking about union with Christ.
In many ways. I mean, and that would come back to some of the more common or the more popular soteriological books of late.
Right.
A lot of books on union with Christ. It's been a hot topic all through the 2000s. So it's something that's only going to continue for the time being, but I think we're seeing it being augmented now within ecumenical discussions with the East. So
right. Now, let me ask you, mm-hmm. I mean, does he deal with the contravention of the creator-creature distinction concerns about that?
Oh, yeah. He's very keen to maintain that distinction. He calls it the creator-created distinction, which might be more common parlance outside of our circles. I'm not sure. I haven't heard many people use that phraseology. Usually we say creator-creature, but it's the same exact thing he's mentioning. And he tries to lay evangelical concerns to rest to say figures like Irenaeus and Cyril of Alexandria are not intending to bridge this gap. They're not trying to say that deification makes us, you know, share in God's essence. So there are different models of deification. I actually heard Ben Blackwell present at the ETS meeting in Milwaukee several months ago.
Oh, okay.
And he was presenting an attributive model of deification, which is that we share in the attributes. More or less, just to boil it down quite simply, and I hope I'm not sacrificing the meaning of what he was trying to get apart or get across, but more in the thought of communicative properties or
now,
covenantal properties and other, right. You know, Oliphantian words.
Is there any of the Gregory Palamas in the background, you know, the essence and energies distinction?
You know, that doesn't come in very much at all. I'm trying to remember if it was mentioned in this book, but it's definitely not a main feature.
That's, of course, a later development in the Eastern tradition.
Right, and he's dealing most closely with Cyril and Irenaeus, or quite early. Again, the book by Ben C. Blackwell, Christosis, Pauline Soteriology in Light of Deification in Irenaeus and Cyril of Alexandria, published by Moore Seebeck. It's available now, and it's worth a read for those who are wanting to get into the field and wanting to learn more about new scholarship in theosis and deification. If you'd like more information about our program, you can visit us online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find other reviews and other discussions on a whole host of theological topics. Thanks for listening.